Among other things, have you studied and defined your process for getting the necessary memos out?
Certainly, the what was already a recognized fact, Congressman, and that is that that operation up there is in a glass house, has been reaffirmed by our experiences with respect to that memo. And I'm, and in fact, I can refer to a late evening phone call from Valdez yesterday evening. I'm sure that a lot more care and wording in memos written will be true in the future. But here again,
why? Because somebody is trying to interpret the advice, the content of the Harrison memo to summarize it. To me, it came across as these are timeless words in a memo. For safety and operational reasons, Exxon will conduct no cleanup operations during the winter. And then point number three, our only commitment for the spring of 1990 is to survey the shorelines. What you've said here to Alaska and to the people of the country to me is we've been here, we came, we saw, we fouled your beaches, that we're going home, goodbye, and have a nice day. That's the way that memo comes across.
Clearly it's subject to misinterpretation, and it was intended, again, not as a communication to the Coast Guard, or certainly not to the Alaskans or anyone else.
Have a nice day.
Ms. Campbell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could just change the focus a little bit, it's my understanding that salmon industry, the fishing industry in Alaska is about a $400 million a year industry, and that the salmon portion of that, particularly those fish that are taken with the Kodiak fleet, is just about a wash this year. It's just about non-existent. Is that correct, Mr. Kelso?
In the areas affected by the spill, the salmon season has been really hit hard.
Well, my question then is for Mr. Stevens, and that is what role is Exxon taking with the fishing fleet that, as I understand, many boats are in jeopardy of being lost. People rely on the fishing to make the payments in the boats, and without the fish, they're simply not going to do it. Could you tell us your role in that?
Within days after the spill, we set up our first claims office in Valdez, and then within a week in Cordova, and the last count I had, we had claims offices in 8 towns, villages in the impacted area, including Kodiak, Homer, Kenai, Seward, so forth. Well, Anchorage and Valdez and Cordova, I may have omitted one.
What do you actually do in the claims office when a person comes in who's about to lose the boat? That's what I want to know.
We're working on an advance basis where there is evidence of damage, and as the seasons have been closed and it's clear they're not going to open, an advance system has been put in place. We're not requiring individuals to make a final settlement and waive their rights. In fact, most of the people we're settling with in terms of advances, partial settlements, and so on, are members of class action lawsuits, and many of their rights have been preserved under those lawsuits. So we're not using, and I think this is the thrust of your question, Congressman, we're not using a cash flow crunch to force settlements by people. It's our very strong desire that we can settle all of the damage claims in the area without resorting to lawsuits. But let me say at this point in time that we have about 150 lawsuits filed against us by individuals. 58 of those lawsuits are class action suits. I'd say 20 or 30 of them are overlapping, primarily fishermen interest, overlapping. We had a preliminary hearing in Anchorage a couple of weeks ago. I'm told 65 law firms were represented. So the newspaper article of a few months ago about Alaska being covered by a slick of lawyers, and I apologize to the lawyers on the committee, is certainly true. And admittedly, that doesn't make our job any easier in terms of working with the individuals.
Sixty-five firms and 58 lawsuits.
58 class action, 160 lawsuits.
Okay, I think you answered my question.
We paid, my last count, something on the range of 4,200 claims to date, something in the range of $42 million. And I regret to say we've just gotten into the front end of the damage claims from the fishing season, the salmon season.
Yes, I'd be happy to yield the chairman.
Sam Rayburn once said, "A town too small to support one lawyer can always support two."
No comment, Mr. Congressman.
Mr. Young. In respect for my colleague was here before, I will let him have my time at this time and next come to me. Yes, Mr. Chairman, I noticed the other day in the Wall Street Journal, someone from the Alaskan DEC indicated that all the king's horses and all the king's men can't put these beaches back where they were. Do you have, the three of you, each of you, have some notion as to what the goal, when will we have succeeded? Do you have any sort of quantitative, identifiable time when you will have completed your work?
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Thomas, we're beginning the process of laying out the specific things that we think need to be done to bring this to the right kind of closure in the measure that we would use to describe it, but we aren't really close to that point because we're not at a level where we're trying to decide how clean is clean. There is still so much oil on the shoreline that not even the gross removal has been completed, and it probably won't be completed this year. So we're still a long ways away from being confronted with that question. We're going to use the time in the meantime, though, to lay out specifically what our standards are going to be.
You do intend to answer, at least for yourselves, that question?
Yes. Now, as a practical matter, it may well be that the question is not how clean is clean, but rather at what point do you have to make the practical decision that you can't get sufficient recovery any longer.
Congressman, could I respond?
Please.
The goal for this year's cleanup activities is fairly clear, and that's to try to treat all of the impacted shoreline. The May 24th plan, as I recall, explicitly stated about 360 something miles, if I recall. But since then, estimates have changed in the Gulf of Alaska area particularly, and we're now up, one of my exhibits shows, up to about 730 miles, with 500 plus of that being in the Gulf of Alaska. The goal is to try to, is to treat all of that impacted shoreline by the demob date this year, that is, notionally September 15th. Now, what do we mean by treat it? Remove gross contamination and render the impacted shoreline environmentally stable. That is, so that through the course of this winter, there will not be mobile oil which will interfere with flora, fauna, birds, fish, other wildlife on the shoreline. As well, not interfere with the normal commercial use of those shorelines and those waters. That's the goal. And Mr. Kelso showed earlier a photograph of a shoreline that had been treated and has been re-oiled. Yes, there are shorelines where we have treated and moved on that are re-oiling. Now, why have we done that? If I said our goal is to render it environmentally stable, and I guess one could argue that that shoreline's not stable. In some selected areas, where the oil, in Prince William Sound, where the oil hit the shoreline early, in the early days and was heavily banked up in the intertidal zone and then washed back and forth with the tidal cycles, two a day, 15 foot. Oil seeped into the substrata, and we're finding in the treatment cleanup that we can stay and wash and wash and wash, and we reach a point of diminishing returns in terms of getting any more oil off of that shoreline. And in order to try to achieve the objective of treating all of the impacted shoreline, we move on off of that shoreline this year. In other words, we're faced with a priority problem. Do we stay on one-mile stretch of beach all summer, or do we try to have, I think Admiral Lusk used the term, first pass treatment of as much of it as possible, and we're, of course, following the latter. Now, with some of those areas, and I think we're fortunate, and that's not a major part of the areas that's been treated, but those shorelines that are subject to re-oiling, with tidal cycles coming and going very slowly over a period of time, oil leaches out of that substrata and comes back on the surface. We would expect, based on scientific studies, that over the course of the winter, the natural wind and wave action, particularly on the high energy shorelines, will remove a good part of that re-oiling. That remains to be seen. Our work program is not predicated in that. Our work program and the goal, response to your question, is to try to treat all the impacted shoreline this season.
Thank you. One other short question. Admiral, last night on the TV, I think it was the McNeil report, Mr. Raymond of Exxon stated that DEC, which is, I guess, an agency in Alaska, was not sharing its scientific data. Does that make sense to you?
I'm not aware of any lack of sharing with the Coast Guard. I believe that I heard the McNeil Lear report last night, and I believe he was saying something to the effect that the state of Alaska was not sharing with Exxon. I'm not aware of any failure to share with the federal launching coordinator.
Can you think of any reason why the state of Alaska wouldn't want to share if that would contribute to completing the project?
I can't, sir. I was with several people as we were listening to that last night, and it took me a bit aback.
I didn't have any notion about that, Mr. Kelso?
Yes, I would, Mr. Thomas. I talked on Monday with Mr. Otto Harrison and Mr. Terry Kuntz from Exxon, and specifically asked the question whether in gathering water quality data, for example, they had access to our people and the information, and they said not only did they, but this is actually Mr. Kuntz's comment, that that access was good and that we were in many instances jointly collecting the information. So I'm not sure what Mr. Raymond was referring to. Mr. Chairman, could I add one clarification to Mr. Thomas's comment?
Just let me say, as part of the chair, because the same representation that the concerns Mr. Thomas was made to me, and as part of the chair, Mr. Stevens, I'd ask you to ask Mr. Raymond what he means by that, because that's now the third public forum where that suggestion has been made, and if in fact evidence that it's necessary to make these decisions being withheld or whatever the circumstances are, we got to get it cleared up.
And so, Mr. Chairman, I think I can respond. I don't believe Mr. Raymond referred
to data being needed to make decisions. I think Mr. Kelso's comment possibly did with respect to some of the dispersant or bioremediation testing. But rather, I think Mr. Raymond was referring to a broad suite of environmental studies which both parties have had underway since the early days of the spill. General data, in terms of water column data, toxicity data in the water column, in terms of intertidal zone analyses, bottom sample analyses, so forth and so on, to the best of my knowledge, is not being shared between the state with us. We have over 20 studies, have probably spent $15 million to date environmental studies. All of that data has been made available to every federal and state agency that wants it. And in fact, the protocols for the scientific sampling and so forth have been developed in concert. We are not, repeat, we are not receiving that same sort of sharing from the state of Alaska.
Mr. Chairman, there are two separate functions that are being conducted at the present time. One of them is the field work, which is what we've been discussing. And the other information, I think, that Mr. Stevens is referring to is the damage assessment, which is separate from what we're doing in the field with the federal on-scene coordinator. That's not something that I'm directly involved with on a daily basis, so I can't speak to that. I think all of the potential parties to litigation gather their own information for purposes of...
All of that is being shared.
Well, not all of your information is being shared, however, without recourse to judicial orders. So the point of that is simply that in terms of the work that we're trying to get accomplished, the information that we have is being shared. We rely on the Coast Guard's information. We rely on Exxon's. Where we can, we go out and gather information together to save everybody some money. And that's the way we'd like to operate in this cleanup operation. The one thing I did want to point out is that state law requires removal of the contamination. And I don't want to lose sight of that fact. That's the overall guiding authority that we have to follow. So when I say that we're looking at what is appropriate to require, we keep that in mind. That's where we should be going as a specific goal, and that's Exxon's obligation. As a practical matter, when you get down to a question of whether you can get more oil off the shoreline, we just have to make realistic choices. And I think both the governor and we recognize you have to, at some point, have to decide that you've got as much as you're going to get and use your resources for other things.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Stevens, in your exchange with Chairman Udall, you weren't implying that Exxon doesn't have any lawyers of its own. I mean, no, I think it had a few up there.
But I would say this, Congressman. Many of our activities since the early days of this spill were without regard to our lawyers.
Let me, well, it may be some good judgment on your part. Not to go over old battles, but I think you're probably a little more sensitive to the environmentalist concerns as issues like oil drilling and transportation of oil, double bottoms, and those kinds of issues. I'd hope that not just in this hearing today when you're trying to get away from this memo, but in the future when we work on issues of transportation of petrochemical products and opening up new areas for oil drilling, that Exxon and you would be a leader in showing that sensitivity, not just here where you're deep in it, but in the future as well. I can see so many instances where industry comes with those great assurances that everything's safe, everything's going to be fine, no need to worry about the danger. And afterwards, as in this case is pretty clear, even with the best efforts, it's going to be hard to restore things. Let me ask my friend from the Coast Guard, the cost of the Coast Guard's overseeing of the operation, is that borne out of your budget, or is that then billed to Exxon?
I mentioned before that we do some 8,800 spills per year. As a general rule, the cost of oversight has not been been billed to the company that we're overseeing. Now, in this case, we have an absolutely huge amount of resources up there, and we're doing it somewhat differently. And in this case, Exxon is paying us for many of the expenses that we're incurring. For instance, we had ships up there early on that were providing command and control. We had aircraft that brought up things. They were paying for those kind of things.
And any cleanup done by your people would also be billed to Exxon?
Yes, sir. At the present time, we're not doing any cleanup, but that is the case.
Now, some of the discussion by Mr. Stevens here and at hearings that Chairman Miller held several weeks ago, the question of when the Coast Guard ought to be put in command, whether there's too much of a time lag. Should we change the law to have the Coast Guard's ability to take command of the crisis be immediate Should it be automatic?
Well, we have, right now, we have the wherewithal in the enabling statute for the federal on-scene coordinator to take over as soon as he detects that the responsible company doesn't see fit to conduct an adequate cleanup themselves. So at the present time, we can take over.
Well, Mr. Stevens, did you indicate it took 3 weeks for that determination to be made?
No, I think that's takeover in a different sense than Admiral Lusk was speaking to.
Yeah, I think the previous witness, Mr. Stevens, did mention, as he was showing an organization chart, that several weeks after the spill, that organization chart clearly laid out the situation. I certainly wouldn't want that testimony to suggest that the federal on-scene coordinator hadn't been present. That was when Vice Admiral Robbins got up there. That was when a formalization of processes were done. Up until that time, though, there was a federal on-scene coordinator. I believe, in fact, the individual changed in seniority several times until Vice Admiral Robbins got there.
How long after the actual accident and the beginning of the spill did it take for the Coast Guard to be in command of the operation?
Maybe 5 minutes.
So within 5 minutes of the crisis, you had somebody there making the determination of what action should be taken?
My understanding was that one of the first notifications that came to us was in the near immediate aftermath of the grounding.
Okay. Mr. Stevens, what do you mean by 3 weeks and you might have been able to stop the oil from getting to shore?
Well, I think it's a matter of, Admiral Lusk commented on the level of the individual. It's a matter of the level and the authority of an individual to overrule advice and consultation from a large number of involved parties, be that Exxon or the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation.
The spill was federalized weeks after it actually happened, though.
The spill has never been federalized.
Never been federalized.
No, sir.
So Exxon's still technically in control here?
No, sir.
No.
No,
sir. The way the statute reads is that Exxon has the
responsibility. Does the work.
Well, Exxon has the responsibility. If they choose to do the cleanup themselves, and if the federal on-scene coordinator agrees that they're doing it adequately, then it will not be federalized. And until this point, we have not seen fit to federalize it. Now, you must, I should clarify that it was our people up in Valdez who, through our Vessel Traffic Service Systems radios, found out, first to find out that the accident had happened. And they immediately called their commanding officer. And this was very, very short time after it happened, minutes. And he then became really the federal on-scene coordinator. Now, his first responsibilities were really for search and rescue. Here we had a vessel that was collided, and we were worried about the vessel possibly capsizing, the people aboard it dying. And so his first responsibilities were for search and rescue. And then he got into minimizing or mitigating further impact, and that was delightering. And so then he got into delightering. Simultaneous with delightering came the more typical responsibilities of the federal on-scene coordinator, which is cleanup.
And why do you say you could have done a better job?
Well, this gets into some ancient history or some issues that occurred in the early days of the spill in terms of steps that could have been taken with regarding the use of dispersants to mitigate the impact.
And that was blocked by the Coast Guard?
I don't know who it was blocked by. All I know was that despite our best efforts, we were unable to get authorization to use them for several days.
Vice Admiral. Sir, the federal on-scene coordinator, of course, is given by statute and regulations the responsibility. There are, however, a number of caveats. And one of those caveats is that he can't exercise the responsibility relative to putting chemicals in the water, call it dispersants and other things, if there is a disapproval by either EPA or by the state that's involved. Now, in this case, there was a certain amount of planning that went on in advance. And in that planning process that went on long in advance of the spill, there were areas that were set forth where those 15 or 14 members of the response team, the organizations that were involved, agreed that in some areas you could automatically use dispersants. There were other areas that you couldn't, and it's in that area that we're now focusing.
Let me, and the gentleman from the state.
Thank you. This is the kind of ancient history that really should not be dredged up because of its advanced decomposition state. But let me say that
metaphors are flying here.
That this is absolutely bogus. The situation was this: the state had pre-approved the use of dispersants in a major area called Zone 1, which is a diamond around the tanker lanes. The regional response team had pre-approved it. This was 3 weeks before the spill. And the federal on-scene coordinator, at that time Commander Steve McCall, approved each of the requests for trial application. He didn't have to come back to us for further checking. It was fine with us to go ahead and use it in that Zone 1 area. And in fact, the problem was that the conditions were wrong. The application of the stuff on day one was totally ineffective. Two tests were conducted on the following day that were ambiguous as far as their effectiveness. It had nothing to do with the state approval. And then when there was finally approval, when there was finally a successful trial application, Commander McCall approved its use for general application, and Exxon wasn't ready to go. They didn't have the aircraft loaded, and they couldn't make a delivery until many hours after the full go-ahead. So this is, what this is a litigation strategy, and it's a smokescreen. It shouldn't be given any more weight.
Let me ask one last question, and I assume that the exchange between Mr. Stevens and Chairman Miller put to rest any focus that we ought to place on this memo. The Exxon's not going to live by the implication of that memo. If it was at any time operative, it is no longer operative, and so we don't have to worry about the memo. Let me just ask one question. What does a double bottom cost for a tanker? How much more does it cost?
I said I wasn't a lawyer. I'm not a mariner either, but my understanding is that you're looking at about 5% increase in the cost of a tanker to go double bottom.
And what does a tanker cost, roughly?
Well, the Exxon Valdez, when she was built, came off the way, not off the way, pardon me, she was christened in about October or November of 1986 with spares, cost us about $130 million. Built in San Diego, California.
So it cost you about $137 million if you'd put a double bottom in.
The 5% figure,
yeah.
Congressman,
and,
but let me...
Yeah. No, I just want to ask one last
comment
thing.
Where I think you're
going.
And
what have you spent so far on the cleanup?
Well, let me think. Comment where I think you're going with that question.
Well, let me answer this question, then you can put your editorial comments in.
Last figure I heard, we'd spent about $675 million today.
A third billion a few minutes ago.
Had the shipyard shortly after the spill do a study of this vessel, this accident, to the best of their ability. And had to make a lot of assumptions because obviously there's a lot of data under that ship that couldn't be put into that. They did 5 case studies based on varying assumptions.
Let me tell you what their assumption was. The assumption was even if you had double bottoms, it wouldn't have stopped the spill.
No, it was a technical study. Oh. The conclusions of the studies, and I, again, have not reviewed them. I understand they were of good quality, though, technically. Was it in 3 of the 5 cases, the likelihood is that the vessel would have capsized and gone to the bottom with 1.25 million barrels of crude. In 1 of the 5 cases,
These are the same people
dicey.
Who told us we'd probably never seen a spill there, too.
No, this is a shipyard, marine architects. And in the last case, the vessel might have stayed, or they say would have stayed, and possibly there would have been some less amount of oil spilled. And that really is the heart of the debate, as I understand it, which occurred in the technical community through the 70s and early 80s. It's not an unmitigated blessing, Congressman, I'm given to understand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I commend you again for holding this hearing. We've got to learn these lessons, and this one's a very painful one. As administration moves forward with drilling requests off Georgia's Bank or on the East Coast or in areas of Alaska to make sure that the calculations aren't just short-term savings, to make sure that we take a look at the full cost. And for us in Congress, I'd hope that we'd review some of the cutting we've been doing in the Coast Guard budget. With all the demands we place on the Coast Guard, it seems the height of insanity to then reduce their budget. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rhodes.
Pardon me, Admiral Lusk, in regard to the September 15th demobilization date, let me just ask you, Exxon has conferred and consulted with the federal on-scene coordinator as to an appropriate demobilization date?
Sir, I talked to Vice Admiral Robbins either yesterday morning or the evening before about that, and he's talked to this same Mr. Harrison who authored the memo that has been discussed. About all of the issues that were covered, and it's a continuing dialogue. Mr. Harrison, who is Exxon's responsible agent in the area, is indicating to Vice Admiral Robbins sometime during early August a written proposal. Vice Admiral Robbins, sometime during early August, a written proposal for this phase down for the winter operations. And although we haven't gotten the written proposal yet, Admiral Robbins and Mr. Harrison have discussed it. And Robbins has the idea that that the proposal will contain something like I mentioned before, taking out heavy equipment sometime during mid-September and phasing down the rest throughout the period of good weather that still exists.
Well, has Admiral Robbins given you any indication that he thinks September 15th is not a good date?
The September 15th date was sort of a hypothetical one that was developed a number of months ago. They talked to long-range weather forecasters and the like, and people who had a history of the weather in the area, and it was one that said around the middle of September you can expect the weather to get real bad. Now, of course, what Admiral Robbins shares the concern of Mr. Harrison that they don't have an unsafe operation up there. But in like fashion, he doesn't want to see all activity cease and desist when more work could be done. And I think that's probably Mr. Kelso's view, too.
Well, Mr. Chairman, let me just make an observation in regard to this portion of your inquiry. I don't really see why the September 15th date should be an item of particular concern to the committee, because on May 17th of this year, we reported out to the full House, House Resolution 157, and we had a lot of discussion in the committee about House Resolution 157. And the thrust of HRES 157 was that we, the Congress, encouraged all parties concerned, and particularly Exxon, to push to a satisfactory completion of this cleanup effort by September 15th of this year. And we put that into the resolution and reported it to the House. We, as I said, in the markup, we had a lot of discussion about the feasibility of achieving things by that date. And there were comments about using a date such as that to, quote, keep Exxon's feet to the fire, unquote. And I think the committee pretty well accepted the fact that while we were saying September 15th we want it done, probably wouldn't be done, but we should keep pushing. Mr. Chairman, you said, let me also say that I think that the concern here is a lot of heavy lifting get done between now and September 15th. I think everybody is in agreement that next spring we're going to be back here auditing what yet needs to be done, but to the extent we can mitigate that, what has to be done following the winter, now there still are some very real opportunities in terms of heavy oil-impacted beaches. But it is not to suggest that September 15th ends this one way or the other. A serious effort has to be made. And the point I'm trying to make, Mr. Chairman, is that September 15th has been a date in the minds of this committee and the Congress for some time that, at least for this year, the heavy lifting, as you termed it, would be completed. Not to say that the job would be completed, not to say that we should not be back here next spring auditing, your word, what yet needs to be done. But I don't really see why, in terms of this hearing, and perhaps I've misunderstood you, we are now criticizing the date of September 15th as the time to start winding down activities in this climate year. I certainly will.
For my response, the gentleman quite accurately states the deliberations of the committee and the resolution passed. The alarming fact of the Harrison memo is not the demobilization of September 15th. It is the implicit wording in the memo that suggests that this is a decision that is a loan to Exxon to make and not the Coast Guard, and that they will only do that in consultation. They will not negotiate. They will only inform federal agencies for the purposes of discussions, not for the purposes of seeking approval. And more alarming, that they were only going to come back in the spring for the purposes of a survey.
Well, let me reclaim George.
Well, let me just let no, wait. And the point is, the second part is that the scope and thoroughness of the cleanup shall not be defined by Exxon Company USA, but shall be determined by the Coast Guard in consultation with the state of Alaska and appropriate federal agencies and affected parties to achieve the maximum benefit for fish and wildlife habitat in the Alaska environment. That's what we said we wanted done. And that, I believe, the Harrison memo is inconsistent, and I believe the testimony of Mr. Stevens is inconsistent within the Senate.
And I will now reclaim my time. Mr. Stevens has stated over and over and over again that he apologizes for the tone and the content of the memo, that it's inoperative.
You asked why the hearing was here. I'm just telling you.
I think that the point is that September 15th date was not arrived at by Exxon alone, and as a matter of fact, it had the assistance of the United States Congress in arriving at the September 15th date.
We suggested to the committee in the hearing.
May I have asked, I presume, Mr. Kelso, just one question, slightly off topic, but not totally. It's my understanding that the Department of Interior and the Environmental Protection Agency have approved for limited use on an experimental basis some biological treatment on the beaches. Can you tell us if that experimental use of biological agents has started, and are there any discernible results as yet?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Rhodes, the bioremediation, as it's called, has been under study by the Environmental Protection Agency and Exxon jointly in some test plots in Snug Harbor on Knight Island in Prince William Sound. The initial results are very encouraging, and the EPA recently sent a specific set of guidelines, in fact I think that was this week, to Exxon to guide the use of this material. Basically what it is using the existing organisms, bacteria, in the shoreline and fertilizing them using nutrients that will allow them to reproduce, and in the course of reproduction and growth, they consume the oil, they eat it, and it reduces the impact, at least on the surface. No one is sure whether that will be able to penetrate below the surface, which of course we'd like, but it's very encouraging as far as the surface treatment. We think it's a good idea. You probably would not want to use that technique in things like salmon spawning streams, but in most areas, and in light of the EPA guidelines, it looks to us as if it's a very promising technique that ought to be fully used. Now, EPA is quick to point out that they don't yet know whether what they have observed so far is actually the result of this biological processing of the oil by the bacteria. They won't know that for a while yet, but it appears to be making a beneficial change, and we support its use.
Thank you. Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Stevens, I have a couple of questions. One is, about half the Alaska fishing industry is based in Seattle. It's not only fishing boats, but it's the
Seattle finally admits that half the Alaskan fishing industry is based in Seattle. I want to talk to you about that.
What can I say? He admits it's true. It's not only the boats, but it's shipyards, it's equipment suppliers. Have you been honoring claims for loss of business income on the secondary victims, if you will, of this whole episode?
By and large, not.
But
you remind me of one thing I should have said earlier. We do and have opened a claims office in Seattle. Fish processors, as well as fishermen, if you will, can be or directly impacted, and we have been paying claims to those two, or making advances against claims to those two groups. I would think in Seattle, I can't give you a specific, but the claims office there has been open for 6 weeks, 8 weeks.
And your definition of those who are eligible for making a claim against a future settlement?
The terms that we've used, but I would quickly, well, terms we've used are directly impacted by the spill. If you get into indirect, and there have been some exceptions made on indirect, I should note, second, third, fourth order, extremely difficult to ascertain damages, to ascertain the rights of a claimant and so on. But again, I would say if someone, regardless of how I might classify them, feels they are directly impacted, then I think they should come in and visit with our claims office.
Do you allow any kind of individual claims, that is, for people who have ordinarily worked in the fishing industry every summer and are not able to get
a job? Yes, that would clearly be in the category of directly impacted, and we have been paying claims to process plant workers who are unemployed because of the lack of fishing that's going on, and we have been paying crews on fishing boats. That's in the direct impact category.
You're paying them at an unemployment insurance rate, or are you paying them, how are you deciding? Ordinarily, they work on shares, or that's a very common way to work on shares of the catch.
Congressman, I don't know. Let me respond in writing, if I may. I don't expect the answer will be on unemployment rate, though.
All right. I would greatly appreciate that.
I'll do
because
so.
I think that one of the things that's not understood about this kind of spill is it isn't just an impact on the beaches or on the boats that are directly in Alaska. It is a widespread impact on the economy of the Northwest, and I think that's important for people to understand. I'd like to go on to one other question, though, and that is the cost of this is anywhere from $600 million to $1.25 billion. How do you intend to treat that on your 1989 tax return? Is it fully deductible? How will that be treated in your tax statement for
that? Well, first, let me say I don't know, do not have an estimate of what this operation is going to cost, nor do I have an estimate of what insurance recoveries we might be able to get through our policies against that cost. There's
do
so much.
Do you have an insurance policy on the damage done by a spill from one of your tankers? That kind
yes,
of
in essence,
of London
it's general pollution coverage, and we have several policies that potentially could apply. The largest of which I think is $400 million. How those policies will apply, if they will apply, the terms and conditions, that's probably going to, well, it's certainly a matter of discussion, negotiations between the carriers and ourselves, our shipping company. It could well be in the final analysis a matter of litigation as well. I would hope not. So I'm not in a position to warrant or in any way indicate any figure in terms of what sort of net cost after insurance we might incur as a result of the spill. I would say that, as you know, the tax code treats a handling of an incident like this as an ordinary and necessary business expense, and we would, of course, take the deduction as a cost of doing business.
So that the American people will ultimately...
No, I do not think the American people will ultimately. No, not at all. First...
I mean, a tax deduction is not...
Presumably the money we're spending is going somewhere that taxes will be paid on it. And, you know, we're creating wealth, if you will, which is taxable.
The theory there might be that you should have more spills in that case to create more wealth.
I have some difficulty, Congressman, even commenting. But I do not see the American taxpayer paying for this spill.
You don't consider tax deduction a grant?
No, I do not. I apply for personal deductions against my own income taxes, and I don't see that as a grant at all. I see that, again, as my paying taxes in conformance with the laws of the land.
I guess one of the most difficult things is going to be to decide whether or not this could have been prevented, and therefore you should not get a tax deduction for it, that it is not in the course of normal business. The facts obviously will come out in the courts at some point, but I think there's a real question. Certainly maintenance and repair of your boats and that sort of thing is a reasonable business deduction. But when you get to something like this where there was a clear, where I think there was a clear mistake made, does that then allow you to take that kind of tax deduction? There's a real question that I think ought to be debated a little bit.
Congressman, there are disastrous and tragic accidents all over this country week in and week out. And certainly this is a disastrous accident. Agree with your comment, it shouldn't have happened. But I would have concerns about the precedential implication of a piece of, or of an action, piece of legislation which you're referring to.
I guess the other thing I want to just comment on, I'm sorry Mr. Gadenson is gone, but I think that this ship was sailing drawing about 54 feet of water. The rock, or 55 feet, the rock was at 51 feet. That's about 5 feet of clearance you needed. The formula that was being examined during the 70s for double hulling would have given you about 11 feet of clearance on that. And it's very difficult for me to see that the extra $6 million or $7 million, whatever it would have cost, would not have been a good investment. That's obviously a comment that there's dispute about. But I think it clearly is an issue that this Congress is going to have to look at.
Well, and as you're probably aware, Congressman, the American Petroleum Institute has made a recommendation that the National Academy of Sciences do a study to reexamine the issue of double bottoms. But let me say, with respect to the prior studies of that issue, it was not a cost factor that decided the issue for many companies. And of course, there are some double bottom vessels around.
Yes, I'm aware of that.
But I don't think that, as I understand it, I was not around or involved, that the conclusion of those studies was based on cost.
It's your assertion that your studies in your company said that it would have been unsafe. I mean, that's the reason why it would not be a good idea. It's very difficult for me to think that there are tankers out there that have double bottoms. Marine architects have got to be on the hook already for that, and I can't believe that they would build and sign their name on a ship and then sit back and wait for them to hit a rock with the potential liability you're suggesting. I just don't. I'm eager as you perhaps are to see that National Science study, because I think there's some real question about why they were not done in the 70s.
If I could just expand a bit on that, it's the Coast Guard that is doing the study with the National Academy of Sciences, and we are funding it. There have been studies done in the past on the issue of double bottoms. You might remember when we were developing the international standards regarding the protection of tankers, there were studies done back in the 70s. The issue is really a very complicated one. Do you want to protect the sides of the vessel? Because we have many collisions. As a matter of fact, we have more collisions than we have groundings. Or do you want to protect the bottom of the vessel? What is the mix that you want? And back there during the 70s, when they did these studies,
It was decided that there would be certain options, but that we in the United States would not press the international community to go exclusively for double bottoms. Now, my people have also done studies in the aftermath of the Exxon Valdez, and we've had computer runs and come up with some alternatives, and we have come to some conclusions about what would have happened had there been double bottoms of different depths on the Exxon Valdez. And certainly under the situation exactly as it happened, where that vessel got stuck on a pinnacle of rock, with no changes in the circumstances, that one, for instance, we do believe that there would probably have been considerably less outflow of oil. On the other hand, there are those who would argue that we might end up with many, many great problems if we had gone exclusively to double bottoms. That we might end up in some cases with vessels that would capsize. We might end up with, had that vessel not been on a pinnacle, for instance, considering the fact that it's the bottom that's torn out and the tanks that might be punctured, we might have ended up with a situation where we take tremendous amounts of water in those tanks, loaded tanks, and you might end up with a sinking vessel or a capsized vessel. So these things are not black and white. And that's the reason why we have some very great concerns. We had concerns back in the 70s. The international community had concerns, and that's why we referred it to the National Academy of Sciences.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This isn't a Sam Rayburn saying, but this is a Don Young saying. Don't play around with bottoms until you know what you're talking about. I happen to be one that do not and hasn't ever supported double bottoms. I think their ballast, as the Admiral has said, is incorrect. The potential explosives through stress of the inner shell to the outer shell is very evident. And when we start fooling around, it's like methanol, a big buzzword now, we start buying through congressional action something that isn't really the state of the art. And I believe the scientists, I've been on that committee, I've studied, I'm a maritime person, that this constant theme song, the double bottoms would have prevented this, is pure, absolutely not true. So I hope we don't get locked into this idea that this is the ultimate, a double bottom. There are other systems that could be approached, and I think that the industry should be approaching it. And I'd like to suggest one thing, Mr. Chairman. Of all the other 70% of oils being shipped into our country, come in on single skin ships from foreign seas with little safeguards. And Admiral, I'd like to ask you a question along those lines. The last three spills we had, one in Delaware, I believe, Rhode Island, and one in Louisiana, all foreign ships, who picked up the bill on those?
The one in the Narragansett Bay area was federalized very quickly by the federal on-scene coordinator.
Taxpayers paid for it.
Pardon?
Taxpayers are paying for it.
Yes, sir. Although we certainly will be presenting the bill to the company that caused the spill. The ones, the other two that you mentioned, I believe are being funded by the responsible party.
Well, the reason I ask that, I believe the largest spill before this one in domestic waters was in Philadelphia, 300,000 barrel spill, and they walked away from the ship. And took full credit for nothing. And I just like to keep that in mind.
Yeah, my staff is telling me that we also federalized the one in Houston, sir, so I was incorrect in that regard.
See, this is very important for, I believe, the media especially understand. In the case of this tragic disaster that's happening in Alaska, Exxon and defense of Exxon, in fact, did not walk away. And they did have that authority. And they did take the responsibility as a American company to try to fully fund this cleanup. And I believe this hearing, Mr. Chairman, today is to referring to a memo. And if I can encourage Mr. Stevens to answer it with a short, concise answer, it will be done and you will be back in the spring.
Yes.
Thank you. Second thing is, I have a series of letters on my desk from Alaskans that are working on the project. There's sort of a theme running through it. Is who in the hell is in charge? They claim that the people that are foremen have never been foremen before, that there's no experience in this cleanup. And in fact, one letter says they worked 14 hours and recovered one half barrel of oil. This is supposed to be a contaminated beach. Now, which one would like to comment on who decided that was a contaminated beach?
I'll try to, as best I can, the determination of which beaches have to be cleaned up is one that is made by a multi-agency group that is responsible to Admiral Robbins. I haven't heard anyone challenge until now that that they suggested that beaches that weren't contaminated were categorized as ones that had to be cleaned up.
Well, the question, Admiral, is my question. This is the guy in the field. This is my grunts. These are my constituents that are working there saying, what are we doing this for? Now, they like the $17 an hour, but one half barrel for 14 hours for 40-man crew does not add up.
No, it certainly doesn't. But that's the kind of thing that the efficiency of the operation is not one that my people get involved in. If Exxon is saying that they're going to do cleanup and they're funding it, so long as the federal government isn't funding it, we're basically making sure it's cleaned up as it has to. But we don't get involved in whether they do it efficiently or not. So I would have to defer that to...
How are you going to make the decision as a federal agency that this beach is no longer needed cleaning? That beach should probably never have been touched. Who's going to make that decision?
Well, I assure you, before any decision is made that a dirty beach is clean, that it will be cleaned and it will be examined, and it'll be Admiral Robbins who makes the decision, sir.
Otherwise, clean is clean is clean.
Well, you know, the definition, as Mr. Kelso said earlier, what is clean? There is no question in my mind, but and he mentioned how much is enough. I'll also throw in another little luskism that certainly we will probably find come springtime or even before that, that there are members of the scientific community giving us advice that further cleanup efforts in some areas would probably do more environmental damage than leaving the oil there. And I expect that to happen. So I don't know how we're going to make that decision. I'm glad it's Admiral Robbins. Okay.
Mr. Stevens, you had about 12 million man hours put in so far?
11 and a half, I think, was the figure I quoted, Congressman.
So that's about $204 million that the company has paid out so far in wages? That
sounds about right.
Going back to the gentleman from Washington's question on the boats, how many of those boats, or could you submit it to the record, are actually from Seattle working on the oil spill?
I suspect I'd be better off not getting in the middle of that.
Well, I'm just a little bit curious because my...
We'll accept that for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, my interest in this, Mr. Stephen, Mr. Chairman, if I may, is that there is a flotilla of about...
1,000 vessels.
1,000 vessels.
Yeah, all sorts.
Of all sorts.
Barges.
Okay. Now, for my closing comment on this, and this may not sit too well with the state of Alaska, but I do support the September 15th cutoff date for starting to demobilize the effort as long as you're back in the spring. As I mentioned, I believe I'm the only one in this committee other than Mr. Miller has been to sea and has worked on the waters and made a decent living out of it and sometimes went broke. At the chains of the equinox, the winds that come through the Hinchinbrook Straits up through the Prince William Sound are extremely dangerous. And I don't know how many of you have been up there, but there are living quarters, and I'm sure the Admiral will agree with this, that should not be there. They're flat-bottom barges with little ballast, great width and length, with two-tier living quarters placed upon. At a 40-mile-an-hour wind, you have a strong possibility of having either a grounding, and more likely at a 65-knot wind, a capsizing, and an 85-knot wind, which happened 3 days after the spill. 85-knot wind, you would, in fact, probably lose up to 300 people or 200 people, however many were living on board that vessel. Now, so far, other than that, I was going to make a pun, but the gentleman that got into the dumbwaiter, we have had no casualties. We've had injuries. And I don't want to be part of a establishment that says that you will continue fighting this disorganized war and lose and loss of life could occur. I want you back in the spring. You said you'll be there. There will be analyzation of that. I am satisfied with that. But to have a vessel in that area with the configuration, Mr. Chairman, I have seen is absolutely ludicrous. It's dangerous. is unseaworthy, and I'm surprised, frankly, from the Coast Guard that some of those vessels were given permit to work in that area. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There are two points that have come up in both Mr. Young's comments and Mr. McDermott's that I think are important. Mr. McDermott raised the question of the secondary effects, and the discussion was in terms of Washington-based impacts versus Alaska, but that wherever they are, the secondary effects are substantial. And let me describe a couple of them to you. One is on small businesses, and the other is on communities, on the cities. For a small business, like a hardware store or a grocery store or the local ship chandlery, normally those small businesses would be helping fishermen gear up for a season, and then they would be supplying them throughout that season. And it's a very aggressive, intense time in those communities, and that's what they use to get through the rest of the year. If you pull out that fishing season, the fisherman may still get compensation for his or her direct losses, but what about the hardware store that's not going to be outfitting that vessel, or the grocery store that's not going to be feeding the crew? Those are serious situations for people in Kodiak or Cordova or wherever, because those folks still have operating loans to pay or mortgages to make, and compensation for those secondary impacts is very important. For local cities, it's equally difficult, because suddenly this spill has taken resources that they had committed for other things, whether it was public safety or street repairs or some other factor. Suddenly they're having to spend that money on spill response, and we have local towns in the spill area that are in some trouble because of it, and the mayors of those communities, of course, are not happy at the situation they're in. They've been working with Exxon. They've not been able to strike an agreement with Exxon, but those are the kinds of things that I think are still outstanding questions and a very important part of this. The other thing that I wanted to mention that Mr. Young raised is the efficiency of certain operations. Making a determination that a shoreline segment needs to be treated is not necessary.